Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. You won't know it on the other side, but Jen and I tried to start the recording, and Skype does this thing where it says starting recording, and then eventually it says recording. And it usually takes like 5 or 6 seconds. And we were sitting here, and Jen was being super quiet, and we were like up to 30 seconds, 31 seconds, and it wasn't working. And so...
It's so odd to just sit there in silence because I know you're searching for buttons, you know, because I can kind of see what's happening, but Skype's not doing their job. And I'm like, do I say something? Or, you know, it's just so awkward. And then we realize that, you know, we're having technical difficulties, but it seems like we've got it together now. So
we do. And it was just so
sitting there quietly. Friday. It's Happy Friday. Yay. It's the best day ever, right? Best day of the week.
It is. Best day of the week. I believe that this is the last Friday prior to fall. I know that Steve enjoys when I make some kind of calendar reference. So I shall do that. We got a lot of requests for the whole Gabby case, and, it is on our radar. However, there's a lot that's kind of happening with it. And so we're going to talk about it next week. So that way maybe we have, some things that have been concluded, and obviously we want to talk. There's been that speculation that maybe that couple that was murdered or whatever, but as Jen pointed out to me earlier, the guy who supposedly murdered them doesn't really look anything like the other guy.
So. Yeah, so we're hot on that trail. We've put things together. You know, we are prepared to podcast on this, but we are waiting for law enforcement to perhaps verify or okay, maybe just one more step so that we can talk about something we really want to talk about without jeopardizing any type of investigation, because NT and I always get a lot of things really fresh off the press and not going ahead of law enforcement. We're just waiting on them to, open the door a little bit, you know, and then we can stick a foot in and tell you a lot more things that have not yet been mentioned. So that's the cool part about waiting until next week. So just bear with us on that. And if you know someone that's interested, be sure to get them to subscribe, because they'll probably really love that episode.
Yeah. And speaking of something that we talk about every week, and it's not even Milkman any longer.
You know, I really miss that. We need more locked room mysteries, more people talking
about
Milkman.
We have a locked room mystery today, kind of.
I want more.
Kind of. I'm excited to talk about it, right? It depends. I mean, I'm not really sure that it's technically a locked room. It's just kind of a disappearing thing, but nobody saw them leave the building, so it's kind of locked room-ish. But I'm excited to talk about that and the fact that you found it, because I think that we had run through kind of basically every kind of locked room. But if you're listening to the first part and you're going, oh, they're going to talk about the Murdochs again, which we are.
I told you guys it would be Murdochs until the wheels fall off. And also, I never agreed to not talk about the hikers if they will ever allow that case to go anywhere in life. You see, they're being secret squirrel. So, you know,
we're not going to talk about the hikers today, though.
No, not today.
But if you don't want to hear the Murdochs and you want to hear the thing, I don't know where it's going to start, but it is definitely very similar, to Elisa Lam. So, super similar. So you're going to want to kind of stick around for that. And it's also a little bit like the boy in China that was hung. It's a little bit like that too, in a sense.
If you really love a good mystery, a whodunit, you need to stick around for the mystery that we're going to deliver after the Murdochs, because a lot of people haven't heard it. And I can assure that you haven't heard it, and you're going to love it if you're into that type of stuff.
So the Murdochs, it is, as I said last week in the title, it is the gift that keeps on giving. I was going to add more to it, but then I figured that the title would be so long. I was going to reference Christmas Vacation and the Jelly of the Month Club. But the title would have been too long. So I just said the gift that keeps on giving, and I should have said the gift that keeps on giving Clark or something like that. but the Murdochs, when you were emailing me this week and you said, oh, well, you know, and I was thinking to myself, you know, South Carolina is obviously going to be a state where you're not allowed to have somebody kill you. However, the crimes of which Alec Murdoch is charged has nothing really to do with, hiring somebody to kill him. It's more, insurance fraud, conspiracy to commit insurance fraud, filing a false police report. They're all felonies.
They are. He's working on that cupcake prison aspect right now while SLED continues to put their investigation together. And that's where the charges for the murder for hire, that kind of stuff will come into play. Whatever else he's done, whatever else he's connected to, or the person that he's pointed out as Smith, the person he hired to kill him, whatever those two are looking at, SLED will let us know. But as of right now, it takes a minute to put all that together because you want it to be solid when you take it to court and you prosecute it. You want it to stick. And being who Alex is, it's important to make sure that it's completely kosher.
Yeah, I think that...
Financial fraud's a good start. You got to admit,
it's a good start.
Like the tens of millions, and even though it's family, they're looking bad at this moment. Also, due to the fact that we've uncovered a whole lot of things that law group did that was not.
Yeah,
how do I say it? Up to par. I mean,
unethical. They were unethical.
Unethical.
But we're going to talk about how small town kind of thing this place is, and. One of the things is that Murdoch, when he went to court to get his bail, and he didn't even have to put up any of his own money, by the way, to get out. He was wearing a jail jumpsuit, which his son never had to do, which people were really upset about at the time, saying, oh, he got special treatment. So they knew this time, Murdoch, he had to wear a jail jumpsuit in his booking photo and everything like that.
His head looked like it was screwed on tightly. I didn't see any brains missing or anything like that. So that part's interesting. Yeah.
And one of his lawyers, Dick Harpootlian, which is quite the name. And
oh, boy.
you know that when he was a kid growing up, they called him Dick Harpoon. You know that they did. There was what he said in court was the lawyer said the only violence he's ever been involved in this, which was to have himself executed. The only person he's a danger to is himself. So the judge said, hey, yeah, OK, go ahead. You can go out on bail. You don't even have to use any money. She did say that he had to give up his passport and also waive extradition because he's going to rehab in Savannah. So they want to be able to get him back from Georgia should they need to and not have to go through all the formalities of extraditing him.
Yeah, the fact they keep allowing him to cross state lines is shady, in my opinion, because they have rehab facilities in South Carolina, and there's just no reason for him to keep running to Savannah. They give him way too much leeway.
One of the things, and because he wasn't really injured, I mean, he did have visible signs of injury. They kind of walked that back that he didn't. Now they said that he did. But it didn't look that bad in that mugshot, like you said. But he thought that his explanation, the lawyer's explanation, was he was going to have somebody kill him because he thought that his insurance policy wouldn't pay out if the death was ruled a suicide. First of all, he's a lawyer. He should know better. He's probably looked at a bunch of life insurance policies. And generally, the rule is... after the first year, you can go ahead and kill yourself. Sometimes it's 2 years. But anything, and he should have known that because he's been a lawyer forever.
The fact that he has the mindscape to even fathom what the whole plan that he cooked up. I mean, they have to look at other stuff that he could possibly be good for. They can't say that he's not a danger to the community because when we start talking about some of the things that we've uncovered, actually him and the unethical, in my opinion, law firm have done things to the community, such as, rip them off, lead them astray. It's all in the notes, not just local notes, but FBI notes, SLED notes. They did victimize the community in an aspect. If you look at it, that is harming community, right? It doesn't have to be physical. It can be mental. It could be gaslighting. It could be, like you said, the financial crimes continue to mount. These lawsuits they rack up with people when they do them dirty, they don't go on to get paid out. That is victimizing people over and over and over again. So how will they know that that won't continue?
And here's the interesting kind of part. The fact that it came out. Well, my one point is that because I know that he should know, first of all, if he just doesn't know from general experience as a lawyer, and he should as a 53-year-old lawyer who's presumably been practicing for 25 or 30 years, is that you're going to run into a bunch of life insurance policies. These kind of things come up from time to time in any kind of practice. And also the fact is he probably has his policy and could look at it, and there's no language in there that he's not going to understand. So I think that his whole point of doing it was to throw everybody off the scent. It was something else.
Well, probably, but what did he use all of the money that he misappropriated from the law firm for? I mean, he could not have spent that much money on drugs, because it's supposedly oxycodone addiction. He's in rehab for that. I mean, tens of millions of dollars is not all spent on drugs. Okay. There's just no way. What did he use the money for? You know, he's got dead family members, and, you know, the family's asking him, where's the money? It seems like he couldn't come up with it, and he didn't believe in his mind there was a plan of ever coming up with it, because as soon as the law firm notified him, we are doing a forensic audit, we are very suspicious of you, it was literally that day or the very next day that he decided, I need to suicide out, I need to pretend to have a flat. That's when his life started really unraveling. That's when he made plans that were dangerous to himself.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting is we talked about in the first time that we did the Murdochs, and we talked about Stephen Smith, and we'll talk about him in a little bit more detail in a minute, but not as much as we did the first episode. But we said that Sled had reopened, well, not necessarily had reopened. What they did was they called Stephen Smith's mom and said, hey, where were you when the Murdochs were killed, the mom and the son? And that's when she realized, oh, they're taking an interest in all this kind of stuff. And Sled actually has reopened the investigation into Stephen Smith's case. But that's kind of a little bit more in the back burner, because one of the other ones that was reopened is the death of Miss Satterfield, who, again, was the housekeeper, the longtime housekeeper for the Murdochs. And what we have found out is that Miss Satterfield's sons, who were in their 20s, said this week that they had never received any money from a $505,000 settlement with Mr. Murdoch over their mom's death, and that Murdoch himself had introduced them to the lawyer who represented them in the case. And so we have a Tom Girardi situation. If Tom Girardi had also been involved in a whole bunch of killings and an attempted self-imposed hit on his life kind of thing. But
yeah,
it's
kind of like that, and kind of like the staircase murders, where the guy tried to say that the owl did it, and he's linked to two other women who fell down staircases and died. So this Miss Satterfield, the housekeeper, 2018, she falls down some type of stairs. It doesn't say how many. And then she dies from those injuries. The coroner writes it off as death by natural causes. That is the manner of death. Natural. Okay, so if you have a slip and fall, it's an accident or it's homicide. It's not going to be natural. It's not natural for you to slip and fall and die.
Yeah, and one of the things is, and we'll talk about it in a second, is that the coroner said that they never actually said that, and that they never did an autopsy on the body.
They didn't. So, there was no autopsy on her, and you know, when we talk about the Stephen Smith, a lot was wrong with that as well. The coroner's office was having a terrible time keeping their ducks in a row. A lot of things were overlooked or covered up. A lot of people went on to leave or were fired. So when they talk about the coroner's office being really messy, yes, because if you went up against the pathologist that was a heavy hitter for the Murdoch family, you got fired. No one questioned the pathologist in this county unless they wanted to lose their job. And that's why you see a lot of law enforcement people that have either jumped jurisdictions over the years, or they, too, do not want to question the Murdochs. The townspeople don't want to question the Murdochs because it would equal a loss of income.
And not to confuse everybody with the last name Smith, but Curtis Smith is the person who was the one who was hired to kill Murdoch. And it's one of Murdoch's former clients.
And he's a really bad shot, apparently.
Well, apparently not only a bad shot, but he is also the person who sold Murdoch most of the oxy. So he was his drug dealer. So he's a former client, a drug dealer, and a horrible shot for a drug dealer.
Yeah, 61 years old when they popped him, arrested him. He was caught and also given a distributing charge, so he had some weed and stuff on him.
It's interesting that he was one of his former clients, because I don't recall that Mr. Murdoch did criminal defense. But if he did do criminal defense at all, the fact that he had so many judges in his pocket, just that's who you'd want to go hire, is Murdoch.
Absolutely, because he knows everyone. They always say, you know, if you want to win the case, know the judge. That's how it works in corrupt counties. And then if you are in criminal defense law, you have, say, a drug case. You know, you're prosecuting a case to where your client is really messed up with the DEA, and you learn everything that client has, what they distribute, what they have in their possession, what they can get their hands on. If you yourself are in an addictive situation, you know, it's really sad. I hope people can get help, but they will use that as leverage to try to gain whatever it is that they are shopping for, whatever illicit narcotic. And they'll say, hey, I'll get you out of these charges. You have to pay me. And also, you've got to hook me up. And it could have been a situation like that, because it seems like that the Murdochs and the law firm they're connected to collect a Rolodex of people that go on to be useful for one reason or another.
Yeah, and that's why I've had some thoughts. And I'm still convinced that there was two people who killed mom and the son.
Because, like I said, he took all of that money. We're talking like millions and millions of dollars. And how they did not realize millions of dollars were missing, not just immediately, but just within a couple months, is really suspicious. Because how were bills getting paid? What type of money was this law firm raking in? You know, what excuses was Alec Murdoch giving? But if he went on, per se, to use the money towards hitmen, stuff like that, we can't put it past him, because he hired someone to take his own life, you know, to potentially take him out. So, you know, I just worry about that. And it always comes back to being his guns. You know, Maggie, Paul killed with at least one of the Murdoch property guns. Alec Murdoch goes on to give 61-year-old Smith one of the Murdoch guns to also end, you know, Alec's life. These fingers, like I said, they're all pointing back to Alec Murdoch. So to me, nothing's off the table, and Sled's doing a really good job of meticulously going through and making sure they connect the dots.
When you hire a hitman to kill somebody, 99.9% of the time, they won't. And there are also, they could be some kind of law enforcement person. Because Murdoch is dealing with these this element, he kind of knows who is going to do it and who won't do it, and who's going to talk and who's not going to talk. So I don't think that he hired Curtis Smith to shoot his wife and son. However,
then how did he know he would go through with it? How did he know he was not paying into an empty investment?
Here's my thing about that. I think that he hired somebody to kill his wife and son, but not Curtis Smith. But because he was so successful in that hiring, and probably the person or persons are long gone, he said, oh, I could do this again. Let me hire my drug dealer, Curtis, because I know that Curtis won't say anything because he's my drug dealer, and have him shoot me. But Curtis didn't do a good job of it. So I don't think Curtis was the person. Also, I don't think Curtis was the one that shot the Maggie and Paul, because of the fact that he was arrested by the police for this. I'm sure they put the question to him about it, if he knew anything about the deaths. And I sincerely doubt that if they had any kind of question, that they would have let him out on a $50,000 bond. They would have done something or come up with some other kind of charge to keep him in longer. That's kind of the way I think about it.
Well, that's not a bad theory. I mean, Alec is the type of person who exudes an air of this untouchable arrogance, and perhaps it finally caught up to him. The problem is, when you start bringing more and more people into your criminal fold, that's normally when you get taken down, because that is just one witness too many. And, you know, if he's hiring multiple hitmen, he's getting all wrapped up in this underworld of seedy people that are willing to do things that are illegal. Eventually they will tell on you. And it seems like what happened is Alec, he ratted out Smith, his hitman, and then the hitman was brought in by Sled, and then he corroborated Alex's statement. So those statements, they align, and they go on to tell on each other. So Sled will wrap that right up in a pretty bow.
I think that the way, if my theory holds, that I think that that Alec has hired somebody and then that person is long gone, person or persons is long gone. I think that they were probably paid a lot of money because Murdoch had a lot of money. I don't think it's going to be easy to figure out what account it came from. It could have just come from a safe deposit. I think that what was going to happen, though, is eventually that person or persons is going to run out of money. And then they're going to go back to their life of crime, which they probably had prior to this. They're going to get arrested, and they're not going to want to go to jail, and then they're going to turn on Murdoch. But I think that it's going to take a while, in my theory, because I think that they are long gone, at least for right now.
I think Sled will play their cards exceptionally well, and the deck will not end up shuffled in Alec's favor. It'll come down to it's you or Buster. You know, one of you needs to either confess. This is what we've learned. They'll present them with a couple of findings. This is what we put together. It looks really bad against either one of the Murdochs or perhaps both of them. Do you want to go down for it or your son? Because he seems very adamant about protecting Buster. And I told you last week, you know, if we come back, you know, give it a week because Buster will probably mess up too at this point. And now we see he's wrapped up in this insurance fraud situation to where he thinks he's going to come into life insurance money if Dad's no longer around. You know, the Daily Mail was able to corner him and try to ask him some questions. He was very arrogant, told him he didn't have to answer their questions and things like that. And he was off shopping like he couldn't be bothered. You know, this family's just really strange. So will they pin Dad against son? Probably. You know, it happens all the time. And what Buster knows could be very formative to the investigation into how Sled goes on to close things. I mean, to me, Sled's got a lot to work with and a lot of different angles to come, you know, with Alex, how to come at him with all these angles. And I don't know. I think they're going to paint him into a corner.
Every time you mention the word Buster, all I can think of is Arrested Development. The Satterfield is Miss Satterfield. What came out this week was really interesting. A couple of things is, and this shows you the unethical behavior of everybody in this community who is a lawyer or somebody powerful. First of all, the fact that they didn't receive any of the $505,000 is one thing. And the other thing is that the sons did not participate in the negotiations. They did not sign any settlement agreements. That's what their new lawyers said when they filed a lawsuit on Wednesday against Murdoch and the law firm and the lawyer who had represented the sons. At the funeral, I believe it was at the funeral, Murdoch introduced Satterfield's sons to one of the lawyers who represented them in the settlement, but they didn't know how close the lawyer was to Murdoch.
Yeah, it's gross. So he says, like, you know, I want to introduce you to Corey Fleming. And then Corey Fleming is the person that goes on to help them set up this wrongful death lawsuit. He's supposed to be helping them. And as it turns out, he actually was the college roommate of Alec Murdoch. And he's also Paul, Timmy, the Bad Seeds godfather.
Yeah.
Why would the Satterfields, had they known that, they would not have wanted, in my opinion, to hire someone like that, because how in the world could someone like that be on your side when they're so close to the Murdoch family, the family that you're filing a wrongful death lawsuit against?
Yeah, and also they named as a defendant a guy named Chad Westendorf, who's the banker who was listed as representative of the Satterfield estate, because Murdoch and them didn't let the boys know that they would have been the presumed administrators of the estate as her sons. And they also sued Palmetto State Bank, which is where Westendorf worked. And so, you know, she died. She trips on the steps. Her sons were told that the dogs caused her to trip and that she suffered a traumatic brain injury. And she had worked there for about 25 years. And Murdoch said, you know, oh, my gosh, she's family to us. But then he didn't pay for the funeral. But he tells the Satterfield, the boys, hey, I'm going to take care of you because I'm going to sue myself for her death. And that's kind of an odd thing to do. And
so the law firm that he goes on to turn the Satterfield boys onto collects $177,000+, while the Satterfield boys collect nothing. And at the same time, there is some type of back deal going on where allegedly money is being funneled back to the Murdochs for the reference.
Here's the thing. I think that it was more than $505,000. I think that one of the reasons is because the insurance company said, we're not going to help you with Paul because we had paid out on Satterfield, right? That was their whole thing. We're not going to help you with Paul. We're just not going to do that. I think that this $505,000, I think that there was a check for $505,000. I think that the other law firm took their cut of $177,000. But I think that the payoff was probably significantly more than $505,000. I guarantee you that if the boys had gone to court and sued, they would have got way more than $505,000.
Absolutely, and it would have been done in a professional manner to where they would have actually seen legitimate checks. The fact that the attorney that they were turned on to hiring, he did not file things correctly, he didn't file the wrongful death, it says here, not at all. He worked on it outside of the scope of the court system. He wasn't going back to the boys and saying, this is what we're going to do in court. He's negotiating with himself in whatever manner. You know, that's unclear. Just negotiations within himself and probably the Murdochs or whatever. And then these kids go on to see either a very little money or what they're saying is no money. And it's just, it's true injustice. I mean, I'm glad that I hate the fact that the Murdochs have to go through so much tragedy and they turned out to be such garbage. But at the end of the day, it will open up some of these cases like Stephen Smith that received not even half of the type of media coverage the Murdoch murders are getting. And then it'll help the Satterfield family. And it's just that thing where you say, you know, lies have speed, but the truth has endurance. And this is the race. We're going for endurance here. And I do think that the truth will come out.
And it would not have come out if Paul had not been in that boat accident. One of the things also is that in December 2018, this Westendorf guy, the bank guy who was sued, because he's named as the administrator of the estate, he goes and petitions the court and says, oh, here we go. We have a settlement, and I'd like you to approve that settlement, Your Honor. And the judge says, of course, I'm happy to. And the sons didn't find out about the settlement until it was in the newspaper. That's when they found out about it. And the other thing is, this judge, his name's Perry Buckner, he had to recuse himself from the 2019 boat crash case because of his ties to the Murdoch family. But here he was approving the settlement in December 2018. So that's a bunch of crooked nonsense.
So much craziness. You know, I asked you the two questions, you know, when looking at this, the full picture, at what point does the state of South Carolina have any type of responsibility over these law firms or, you know, looking into this? You know, I know that Alec Murdoch has been disbarred. He's no longer a practicing attorney. But what about some of these other people, and also about some of the law enforcement jurisdictions that have proven they're corrupt and really messed up? And then on top of that, the ethics of things going on in the court system, in the coroner's office, pathology. It just seems like it's very widespread in South Carolina. Do they go through and clamp down at some point, or do they just let the counties ride it out and continue to police themselves?
Well, I mean, a couple of things on that. Look how long Tom Girardi got away with it. He got away with it for decades because he knew the right people. So he wouldn't answer when the California bar would, you know, send him stuff. He would just ignore it. And I never even knew you could do something like that. I thought that if you ignored it, they would just say, okay, fine, you're disbarred, but apparently not. But in this case, they've done pretty well. And the South Carolina Attorney General has said that he himself, he's not going to sign it. Because I think he wants to move higher in politics, but he is actually going to handle the case himself if there is a trial. And whoever's finally charged in the murders of Maggie and Paul, the attorney general for the state of South Carolina is going to be the prosecutor himself.
Is he a friend of the Murdochs as well? Everyone needs to look up campaign donations from the Murdoch family and perhaps vote those people out or vote against them or whatnot, or you're going to keep getting more of the same. I don't think people realize This is all open record, and you can look at stuff like that. And if you live in this community or around it, hell, if you live in South Carolina, you need to make it your business because it is so bad. So many people's lives are affected. I mean, the law firm stands to be completely audited in a lot of their cases. It could even be SLED cases, Hampton County cases that could be reexamined, reopened, overturned. You don't know what can happen in this. It can get real nasty because looking at the case of Stephen Smith, which to me is just an absolute tragedy. The FBI, they came in, SLED. You know, I like SLED. They're doing a good job right now, but not so much back when Stephen Smith was killed. FBI was denied, doing a rape kit on him. Now, remember, he's LGBT. That should have been done. FBI denied cell phone data from his cell phone, also blocked by SLED. FBI denied gunshot residue test, denied by SLED. FBI said no evidence Smith died by what they believe is a hit and run. South Carolina Highway Patrol, no evidence of a hit and run. It's not just that. Not one single isolated incident led to his death. So I ask you, why would SLED block FBI from investigating? They have the better crime lab. The more, and I'm not knocking SLED, they're very intelligent, but the FBI is a different level. Okay, these are highly skilled agents, right? They didn't have to assume the full jurisdiction, but why would SLED not want their expertise?
I think that, well, I understood before it went to SLED why it was being denied, because the FBI was getting the runaround from local jurisdictions. With SLED, I think that SLED's saying, hey, let us at least have a shot at this before we turn things over to you. They have been very thorough and very diligent in the whole Murdoch thing and have uncovered a lot of rocks. So I think that it's entirely possible that they just want a little bit more time. The fact that SLED says that Smith's not connected to the Murdochs is a horribly wrong statement, because SLED themselves, SLED cannot say that. That's what they told the FBI, but SLED can't say that when they're calling Stephen Smith's mom and saying, did you kill, you know, Maggie and Paul? Why would you call her and ask her that if Smith's death's not connected to the Murdochs?
Exactly. That doesn't make sense. And it happened close to the Murdoch property. And the fact that people talk about Randy Murdoch being at Stephen Smith's crime scene, why was he there? He's the brother of Alec Murdoch. Why would he show up to that death scene? And then he goes on to solicit his services to the family, allegedly, and said, hey, I'll help you look into the death of your son. And then at the time, Stephen Smith's father was still alive. And, you know, he wanted to get to the bottom of what happened to his 19-year-old son. So he says, yeah, you know, help me out. But the father goes on to die before there's any type of closure. And my whole thing is that when you look at these FBI files, even if they're heavily redacted, there's a lot of information there. Why are people not leaning into that?
Yeah, I really, most of the time in this kind of situation, I would say, let the state handle it, not the local jurisdictions, but let the state handle it. But the problem is that South Carolina is an extremely small state, and the legal community is smaller, and the judges and the district attorneys, it's even a smaller group. They all know each other. Every single one knows them. I mean, you had Bakari Sellers go on CNN before Alex was shot, but after Paul and Maggie. And then the whole thing came up, and he essentially said, oh, you know, I know Alec Murdoch, and he's just a great guy. He's got a good heart. Well, obviously he doesn't. And I think that, but it just, everybody in the community is just going to stick up for each other. So your question going back to about the attorney general is that I do worry about that quite a lot. Because
SLED knew, like you said, it's a small community. You made a very good point. Everyone knows everyone's business. So when SLED comes out with some type of crazy statement at the time of Stephen Smith's death, we don't see how this could be related to the Murdochs. They don't know each other, or they're acquaintances. It's not close enough. Really? Well, Buster and Stephen Smith were not only classmates. They traveled in the same social circle. Smith came over to Buster's house often. The two played sports together on a team that Alec Murdoch coached. So really, they don't know each other? And the community doesn't speak up and say, hey, SLED, you're wrong? That is a lie from the pits of hell? I mean,
and one of the things also that you brought up, but I don't think that maybe people heard because it was really quick, is Stephen Smith's father, okay, they got the part that he died, but he wanted somebody to look into the death of his son. And I think maybe you said it too fast, but he hired Randy Murdoch, Alex's brother, to look into the death of his son. So just, is Randy going to try? No, he's not going to try. And so it was just doomed from the beginning. Buster and Steven, they were friends, classmates. Like you said, they played on just the whole thing goes down to the fact that Sled called Steven's mom. That's all you need to know. That's all you need to know, right?
She
there.
Had questions for Sled as well. She said, since I have you on the horn, you're asking me these crazy questions. No, I do not have anything to do with the Murdochs or their drama. But while you're on the phone with me, why was my child so paranoid and nervous before he died? That's the question you've never answered for me. I need to know. Of course, you know, either we're not privy to know what they said to her, or she is being very honest when she said they don't have any answers. South Carolina Highway Patrol has a unit called MATE. They do all these accident investigations, the recreations of scenes. You know, Sled tried to say that Stephen Smith was a hit and run victim. There's nothing at the scene that indicates that he was a hit and run victim. There would be a lot of forensic evidence left behind that right. proved that, right? Okay, so he may have been hit at some point, but that's not his only cause of death. He had a lot wrong with him. The problem is this pathologist that was supposedly in the Murdoch's pocket and goes on to, she fights the highway patrol. She fights with everyone who goes up against her in her findings. She says, it's a hit and run, let it go. And they said, no, this boy had a hole in his head, defensive wounds. There was these blue paint chips embedded in his clothing, and they are indicative of what Toyota uses paint wise. You know, you and I have talked about a case to where we said, you know, vehicles, company manufacturers, they use certain types of paints, and you can kind of yes. like narrow down what vehicle, what paint, you know, who made it. So they come to find out it's Toyota. And then Stephen Smith's mom goes, well, I mean, does this have anything to do with maybe Paul Murdoch's blue mule that they used to get around the property? And then yeah,
like a dune buggy.
Yeah, like a dune buggy. And Sled had nothing to say about it. Doesn't seem like the highway patrol had anything else to say about it. But they did go back and ask the coroner to take another look, in which she said no. The people who challenged her were fired, especially in the coroner's office. The coroner fought her like crazy. And then she leaves. You know, she jumps jurisdiction. She's not even there anymore. This pathologist, she's taken off somewhere else. That's why they should stop people from jumping jurisdiction. If there is a problem, a lawsuit, whatnot, it shouldn't be so easy just to hop to the next county and then start creating perhaps the same type of headaches. Because those people don't know who you are when you're coming in. They may not know that you have this awful background and all this baggage and stuff.
And one of the things, it's a crazy case. And every week that we've talked about this, I say to myself, oh, you know, we'll probably have to do an update, but I think it's going to be like a 5-minute update. But honestly, every single week in between Friday to Friday, there is so much stuff that happens. I am going to go out on a limb, and I think that we are going to have a quiet week with the Murdochs. Although I say that, but then going back to what I said last week, is you now have moved on, you know, beyond just two local South Carolina papers. Now there's three or four that are covering it. The New York Times has three people in South Carolina right now, full time. So they are digging and digging and digging and digging. And
so many lives were affected. Mallory Beach, Stephen Smith, the Satterfields. These are just the cases that we know of. Anyone else that they went on to victimize, either, like I said, mentally, physically, by gaslighting, by strong arming, they just had way too much power and flexed it in a way that was not beneficial to their community. And the case is just that bad. That's why we just keep talking about it, because if you are the mother of Stephen Smith, I mean, I just cannot imagine the pain. I want to see her get justice for her son and find out once and for all what happened to him. You know, I care about the Satterfield housekeeper as well, but when it comes to Stephen Smith, 19-year-old kid, how they left that boy in the road and how they tried to cover that up is just, it is horrendous. These things need to be rectified.
Speaking of hit and runs.
Yes.
Or car accidents. There is an update on a case that we've done. And it's a case from 2004. And it's Maura Murray. And Maura Murray was, she's a nursing student, from University of Massachusetts, and her car was found crashed on, a road in New Hampshire, but she wasn't there. And everybody's like, well, where did she go? And so we've kind of talked about that before. And recently they discovered some human remains in Lincoln, New Hampshire, which is about 25 miles away from where she disappeared.
Yeah, and this is the Loon Mountain area, and they did find bone fragments. It is not far-fetched for Maura Murray to have reached that area. Of course, these bone fragments could belong to anyone. They're going to have to go through anthropology and bone testing, you know, to get DNA and stuff out of them. It'll take months. But can you imagine how huge this will be if it turns out to be her? Because I think you and I ended the podcast with the realization that she's probably out there in the woods. She, yeah. You know, deteriorated by now, died from exposure. She was a long distance runner. It's not out of the realm of possibility that she could have traveled quite far, especially with adrenaline pumping to get away from that scene. And then, you know, what I call crash and burn, because, you know, you're exhausted after you do all that running.
Yeah. And it just, there have been leads before. 2 years ago, there was a basement in a different town in New Hampshire that was ripped up after cadaver dogs identified a spot on the floor, and the search came up empty. And, you know, Maura's dad is still alive, and he said at that time, you know, she wants to come home and be buried in her hometown, and she can't. She's buried up here. And, but there's, nobody still has figured out what she was doing there.
Yeah, even if these turn out to be her bones, it will never explain what Maura Murray was really running from that evening. There was a lot going on. You know, when you look at her cell phone calls, you just have the strange pizza people that she was talking to. You have a different law enforcement agency just of high interest that is paying way too close attention to her case, that you look at it and you're like, okay, that's not normal in a search and rescue position or in recovery. She was wrapped up in West Point. She, you know, has the whole military Bill relationship. He goes on to have an interview that is easily searchable, to where he gives a timeline of where he is dating an English woman. He leaves Maura completely out of his life timeline. It is just like the most bizarre thing. I sat there and watched it, and I thought, was this man living a legend? Was Maura living a legend? Like, this is the case of all cases. Like, Renner's not wrong that Maura Murray's case is absolutely fascinating, because it can go so many different directions. But yeah, at the end of the day, you know, I still think that she died of exposure. But what she was running from is just the most fascinating aspect that we all want to know about.
Yeah, I mean, she could have been heading to Loon. She also checked online for hotels in Burlington and Vermont. So nobody really knows. And like you said, even if the bones, okay, they're probably hers. Oh, you know, her sister says, well, great, then we can bring the person to justice. It's not going to be that easy.
No, because she'll be so deteriorated. And that's the thing, is that eventually in these cases, you recover bones, right? But you can possibly learn cause of death if she was shot, stabbed, if those bones are going to talk to you when they're on the medical examiner's table, the anthropology table. If she was, say, asphyxiated or something like that, it'd be a little tougher to tell, unless you find neck bones and stuff like that, and it'll tell the story. I'm hoping that if she is found, she's not scattered. You know, it's not a nice thing to talk about, but normally when bones are recovered, you don't get all of them.
No.
So, you know, it may be an incomplete puzzle, and that would be disappointing. You know, we'd like to know what happened to her, of course.
It is time for this mystery. I'm just calling it the elevator mystery. Actually, I might call it the women in red.
Oh, I like that. The women in red.
The women in red. Although it's a woman and a 4-year-old, but we'll call them the women in red. I have to ask you a question, because I don't remember, and I don't know if you'll remember, but the boy that was hanging, was he wearing red?
He was. And that is what makes these. Let's see, like the Vietnamese, the Chinese, the Taiwan type cases, just very interesting because of their lore and what they believe about the color red. So that's going to be very pertinent to this case as well, just like it is Elisa Lam's, the little boy hanging. And I even have a different case that we're going to go on to talk about, to where it is more red and You're going to love that too.
This takes place in Taiwan, although it's interesting because Taiwan doesn't really seem, Taiwan newspapers didn't really seem to cover it. This actually happened. This is real. This is not some kind of urban legend. This is real because there are, it doesn't have a lot of traction in the Reddit world, so to speak, because there's not a lot of information, but it has been proven to be real. It's what's interesting is other Asian countries find it fascinating. So when you read stories, you're reading them in Vietnamese on newspapers and things like that. And then you're having to try and translate it back into English. And all of the sources essentially are dated, within the last year or two, even though it happened in 2008. I credit that to people on Reddit who are just always looking for interesting cases.
Well, that also, a lot of these countries will allow cases to roll for many years before they start publishing about them. You may have a reporter of some type of journalist, writer, go out on a limb and start discussing the case long after the government allows them to, you know, or long after a family starts making a fuss about it and they want it spoke about. So it could happen, say, January 20th, 2008, and then you're not hearing about it until 2020. It's just because different country customs. They don't think it's appropriate to talk about open investigations as broadly as we do. And as you see here, they're really clamping down on what we can talk about, because if you bring open investigations to Reddit, they take it right off. Same thing with Twitter, Facebook, whatnot. They say you're talking too much. It's too fresh.
So the pictures that are used are from a newspaper called ET Today. It's a Taiwanese newspaper. It is not the New York Times. However, it is not the Daily Mail. It is a solid news organization. So that is kind of what everybody bases all of this on. And you
That's
have,
good. We don't yeah. need, you know, a you non-factual need... website. This
exactly.
is, you know, like you said, this is a good website. They have truthful articles. We're just going to do a crude translation from Vietnamese to English. So just bear with us on that.
Yeah, I mean, so it went from Taiwanese, it's Chinese, basically, Chinese to Vietnamese to English. There is a 37-year-old woman named Lu and her 4-year-old daughter. And they go to the Yuan Lin Financial Building in Zhuanghua, Taiwan. They both enter the elevator of the building, only to never be seen again. And in 2008, just at that time, but it, again, between 2008 and 2020, nobody really talked about it. But when it happened in 2008, it was pretty big news in Taiwan. And the building manager, I get the feeling that he has dealt with this situation before, just by what he says. Because it was late at night, and the woman appeared to be confused. And when he saw that the mother and the daughter were wearing red jackets, he goes, "Oh, God, I know what they're going to do." He just had a bad feeling as soon as he sees them in the red jackets.
See, that's very odd. It's very reminiscent of the Cecil and Alyssa Lam. And I mean, what is with the red jackets? And then, you know, people that are over these different hotels or financial buildings thinking, oh, it's already going to be trouble. And they've had trouble previously, and I don't know. It's like here comes the mystery already building up.
I think that he knew that they were there to commit suicide. That's what he was thinking because of the fact that they're wearing red.
That's so weird. I thought maybe, yeah, the suicide aspect, or they're here to play that crazy elevator game that we all hate them playing, especially like on our elevators. It's a huge liability because elevators – there was a story this week, a Southern story of an elevator that not only collapsed, but really messed someone up. So playing on elevators is never a good idea. So they don't want you doing that. But to see these two people wearing red, you know, he probably had like lots of thoughts.
He did. He said that he was suspicious and didn't want to let them enter the building. It's basically, again, we're Taiwanese to Vietnamese to English. But he didn't want them to come because he thought that they were going to commit suicide, essentially.
But I wonder if he had seen Dark Water, because, you know, she doesn't she show up and then she has a kid? So he's seeing this mother and child. Now they're both wearing red. And that has to be playing in his mind, too, because that is, you know, like the Chinese and lots of Asian countries, they talk about dark water and just like how ominous it is and what a bad omen. They tell people not to watch it and definitely not to act it out. So that could be another thing that they were thinking about.
So the manager confronts them. And the woman said, no, I'm here looking for my friend. And she walks really quickly to the elevator with her daughter. And the next morning, the manager didn't see the two leave the building. Okay, well, what if they left during the night? We'll get to all that. But, again, he suspected that Miss Liu went to the building to commit suicide. And he checked the cameras in the building. And according to the camera footage, she entered the elevator looking very frightened and nervous. And then, when the elevator's door shut, they removed the red jackets. And they even took off their shoes, which is always very, 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 very important when you're talking about Asian suicides.
Yeah, and if you're going to enter the next dimension, you want to do so in a clean fashion. And the removing of the shoes, that's a very important clue as to state of mind.
Yes. So then the woman then dashed out the elevator with her daughter and went out on the side of the camera. And the manager rightly suspected, he had suspected when they came in the red, that they wanted to jump off the building to commit suicide since she took off her shoes. However, the fact that she took off the jackets as well was puzzling because you, if you're going to commit suicide, you want to take your shoes off, but you want to leave your red jacket on. That's the thing with Asian suicide. If you're going to do that, you want to leave the red on, but take off the shoes. So it didn't make any sense that they took off the shoes and the jacket.
It really doesn't, because if they take off the jacket, then they normally use it to asphyxiate themselves and it ends up around their neck. So to completely abandon the jacket, very suspicious.
And so after reviewing the footage of the camera, the police believed there was a high chance that the two committed suicide. So they started, you know, looking around the building and then they get dozens of officers and they're looking everywhere, but there's no trace of the two missing persons or any related evidence at all. And then the police also asked everyone who entered and exited the building, yet no one saw Miss Liu or her daughter. So it's possible that she changed her mind, decided to commit suicide by hanging or cutting her wrist. So then the police widened the search of the inside of the building as well. They checked the water tank, hello, Elisa, and the water pipes, but still, no trace of the two was found. So then the news, obviously, Taiwan, the news goes out. And a man claims to be Miss Liu's husband contacts the police. And this is the interesting part. Because they had four children together, but had been separated for about a year. And Miss Liu was raising the four children while the husband was paying for child support. And this is kind of unusual in the Asian culture. A lot of times, the default in the U.S., in most Western countries, you know, whether or not it needs to be, I'm just saying the default has historically been that the woman gets the kids. In Asian countries, specifically in most Northern Asian countries, the dad gets the kids. The mom does not. So it is kind of interesting that she was raising the children and the husband was paying for child support.
Yeah, that is weird. We've had a case like that we've discussed to where it was an Asian case and the father assumed responsibility of the kids and the mother, she tried to fight, but she didn't win, of course, because their customs are different than us. But it goes on to say that she was hung up on the youngest daughter. She told relatives that she was taking the youngest daughter away for a few days, possibly to live with another relative. And after that, no further information. If you have four children together, why just get rid of one? What was it about her? Is that something sacrificial? You know, was that some type of getting back at her husband? Was that his favorite kid? What's going on with the little one?
Yeah, and Miss Liu told her oldest daughter, who at the time was in the sixth grade, that she was taking the youngest daughter, the one that was in the camera footage, to this relative just for a few days. And then there was nothing really to go on. So they closed it. After 10 years, well, the sixth grader, 10 years later, and this is, I think, why all of a sudden people started talking about it again, is Miss Liu's daughter spoke to the media. And she said that her mother was a very religious person. And so this sparked some theory of the supernatural, obviously, since Taiwanese believe that the color red attracts ghosts and spirits. But they took off the red. They took it off. And the two of them wearing red in the middle of the night. I mean, this is why the building manager just said, hey, I know something's going on here because you're wearing red. It's the middle
to
of
me,
the night.
And, if you enter a building in the middle of the night, and you have no business being there. You don't work there. It doesn't seem like that when they did a forensic edit or contact tracing of the relatives or her friends that she didn't know anyone else that worked there either. So what was their business there? In the dark, entering an elevator, you're wearing a very brightly colored, let's say sweater or jacket. You go on to lose that piece of brightly colored fabric so that you can disappear into the fold of the building. Why did they need to start becoming undetected after they, I guess, assume they exited the elevator at some point because they stripped off those jackets? Their bodies are no longer in the elevator, so they've left, and now they're walking somewhere in the building less brightly. That is really suspicious for someone who's going to commit suicide. Like you said, they leave the bright colored jacket on, and then also, what do they care who sees what at that point? Because she's either going to jump or she's going to do what she needs to do to carry out her plans, regardless, you know, of what's being caught on film. I assume she realized the place was heavily surveillanced.
So one of the things is the residents have said that the building brings bad luck and no businesses have been able to thrive there.
Sounds like the Cecil, doesn't it? It is just, it is uncanny, the parallels. You got a girl wandering around in red. She's, you know, up to no good. She's really nervous, playing around in an elevator. You know, this mother just happens to have a little accomplice with her. She brings her daughter. And then they just disappear. Of course, Elisa found in a water tower that you wonder how in the world she, A, knew it was there, B, knew that she could lift the lid, or that, you know, that would even be a thing without alarms going off. And then you have these people who, were they lured there?
I mean, Elisa was murdered. Elisa's murdered.
Yeah, I'm on board with that all day long. I don't care what anyone else says.
Yeah,
that girl
she was murdered.
Lured there.
Yeah. So some Taiwanese people have been digging into it because they enjoy their true crime too. And one of the things that that's been reported is because there's so many different languages and people trying to do it. There's one version that says that the woman and the daughter lived about 7 kilometers from the building and that the husband was abusive. In one version, they walked the 7 kilometers to the building. And in another version, they rode a moped there. And the moped was found outside the building 8 days later, which is when they looked over the footage to discover they'd vanished after exiting the elevator. And it is a mixed building, residential and commercial. So it is suspected perhaps that they knew someone there. Now, this is an important part if you're going to go with the suicide theory. The building is 16 floors, but they only rode to the 11th, which seems odd if you're planning to jump off. Because you're not getting to the roof from the 11th. So,
okay, but wouldn't their bodies have been found below? I believe passerbys would have seen that. And if they were somewhere stuffed in the building, eventually you would smell them. There's not one body, but two. So that would smell twice as rotten, you know, rotten squared.
Exactly. And they were last seen, maybe, entering the stairwell, maybe going up. And there was a suspicious leather suitcase at the top of the stairs that was searched by the police.
That is so weird. So they enter the building. They weren't carrying a suitcase, right?
Correct.
So it seems like a game to me. They are wearing the red. They use an elevator. And then for some reason, they abandon the elevator. Now they need to use the staircase. There's this mysterious bag. And remember at Elisa and Liam's hotel, the Cecil, there is a rumor of her being handed a cube-shaped box by two men, and no one at the Cecil wants to talk about it. So you have these boxes and these suitcases appearing, and it just seems like some type of weird game that goes really wrong, and it always ends up with someone either missing or dead.
Yeah, and like I said at the beginning, they take off the shoes before taking their lives to avoid tracking dirt into the afterlife, and usually they will take those shoes. If they're jumping off a bridge or a building, they'll put them where they jumped from as a marker that they were there. And also, it's another thing is it's considered respectful to take them off prior to killing yourself because they will fly off and hit people. And if you're in a tall enough building, it can, you know, hit somebody and actually kill them. So that's kind of another reason that they do it. Who knew that there was an entire culture in Asian countries about, okay, well, you're going to commit suicide. Well, first of all, what you need to do, take off your shoes, you know, and all this kind of stuff.
It's a thing. It's called a proper suicide. It's an American thing, too, because in The Most Beautiful Suicide, if you go and look that case up, she took off some of her articles of clothing when she jumped from the Empire State Building, and she folded them up nicely as to leave a print from exactly where she jumped from. She wanted them to be sure before she landed on a United Nations limousine below.
See, there you go. Now, maybe she wanted to disappear for a reason. The husband has been called abusive in some reports. So she could have known someone in the building who hid clothing for her. If you want to be noticed, and this goes back to our cruise ship one, right? When you want to, you know, you come out, you come on the board, ostentatious, loud, flamboyant, and then you leave super quiet and nobody even notices that you're gone. And she wore the red coat. She was noticed. The manager's going to notice two, a woman and a girl in a red coat. So what do? You get in the elevator, you take them off, you get off the elevator, you put some sneakers on, put a hat on, kind of like our cruise ship one. Wait till the building gets busy and slip out. It is a commercial and residential building because everybody's going to be looking for the red coats.
I know, but I would just wonder who everyone is. Like, why do you need so many witnesses? I could see a theory of where she is involved in something, playing a game with someone or meeting up with someone. And she said, you'll know who I am because I'm the one wearing the red coat. It's bright. You can't miss me. You know, that makes sense. But then you have the manager there who I assume she realizes is going to be really really nosy and notice her. And then you stand the risk of not knowing who else is in the building at that time. But then you ditch the red and you disappear. I mean, unless there's some type of trafficking going on. I mean, her taking the youngest kid's really weird. Was the child not that close to her father yet to where maybe the mom thought, okay, well, she's not brainwashed yet, so she's not going to miss him. Maybe these older girls or older kids will, they'll fight me on wanting to see their father, so I'm not going to take them along. So we'll disappear, or, you know, I'll sell my kid and then I'll suicide, or, you know, something just bad happens to them, or they just start a new life by getting snuck out by hiding in maybe like a, you know, like not like a cart. I don't know what type of things they have in this building, the financial building, but any cart with a curtain over it or a linen basket, you hide it under laundry. There's been so many cases of that happens on cruise ships.
Yeah. Well, also what you can do is if you're going to somebody's apartment or whatever, you change and then the woman can go out by herself and then you get a guy to take out the girl. Everybody's looking for the woman and the girl and they're looking for the red coats. But there is a connection between red and ghosts in Taiwan culture. There's this girl in red that was made into a horror movie, The Tag Along. And also Taiwanese, the reason that I said about the red being taken off was strange is because if you are a woman who commits suicide in Taiwan and you're wearing red, then what happens is you create a vengeful and maybe murderous ghost. Now, did she take it off because she didn't want to be a vengeful ghost, or would she leave it on because she wanted to go after her abusive husband? So maybe she didn't want to be a vengeful ghost and took it off.
My argument would be, why would you wear it to begin with? You obviously realize the symbolism of it. So you selected to not only dress yourself in that color fabric, but your daughter as well. That decision's made. You know, it's concrete, and leaving it in an elevator is not going to stop whatever belief you have in your head. Your mind is still traveling with you. You left the coats behind, but the mental, you know, it's attached to your psyche, your physical body. That is still moving in the direction of wherever this woman disappeared to. So, you know, I don't know if she abandoned whatever it was she had in her head. It's just, where did she go? You know, if there wasn't like the ghost aspect, the supernatural aspect, I would say that she just committed suicide or was abducted or something. But there's just something to the whole her needing to wear red and take off her shoes. And
I think two possibilities. First of all, I think that she wore the red so that she would be noticed and be easier to disappear later. Taking off the shoes, so that way maybe people would think that she was committing suicide. Again, it makes it easier because they're looking for a dead body outside and everything. They're not looking for somebody just – in the building. There's a high traffic building.
Okay, I don't understand. Like, I'm stuck. You have to help me. Okay. So like, if I'm trying to disappear, right? I'm trying to lose my husband because he's a real geek. I want to dress down and I want to blend in with the people. I am not going to wear red. I'm certainly not going to dress my daughter as a twinsie so that people be like, yeah, I saw mom and you're right. Your daughter was with her. It's exactly as you described, sir. You know, that's not like low key. That's not blending at all. Why would she advertise a good starting point to look for her? Like, hey, all my prints are here. All the forensic evidence is here. You can hunt me from here. It just seems like that she would dress way down, blend, and not give him any clues at all.
Because you're hunting her from there and she's not there anymore. And you're focusing everything on that building. Everything. You're looking in the water pipes. You're looking in the water tower. You're looking around. You're looking in the dumpsters. Everybody's focused on that building. And meanwhile, she's gone. And I have obviously the daughter, the eldest daughter who had the press conference, but we don't hear anything about the dad. I don't think that the dad seemed all that surprised.
Which is even more curious. I mean, it reminds me of Sleeping with the Enemy. You know, doesn't she disappear in the water? And then when the water doesn't result with anything, he doesn't stop there. He starts looking for her everywhere else, and then he finds her. So I assume that if he really cared to follow through and find her in this missing daughter, then he would have. I mean, it just depends on how smart she was and what type of resources that she had and why she ran to begin with. I assume she is not in that building and the manager is not connected to any type of weird deaths. I mean, like I said, nobody smelled anything.
I don't think that she killed herself. I think that they would have found her. I think that she just wanted a new life. Maybe she didn't like having four kids. Maybe she felt suffocated. Maybe she thought, okay, my other daughters can take care of themselves, but I need to take the four-year-old.
Well, I hope that's true. I hope she's out there living her best life, and I hope the girls are okay with their dad. But, you know, you always hope that a story ends with someone having made their own choice, you know, not being hurt due to foul play or something like that. And as sad as it is for her to walk away, if it's her choice, then, you know, I wish her the best and hope that she that worked out well for her.
Oh, it's a good case, though. It is a good case.
It is. It is just so spooky. And we could not talk about it when, you know, you still have everyone leaning into the Cecil.
Well, I'm excited to hear about the other one in red. So we'll have to do that one. Maybe we can do that next week. And as we end September pretty close, I think next week's will be our last one in September. So the fall will be upon us.
Well, I love Jen, fall. More pumpkin spice and more true crime.
God, you and the pumpkin spice.
I'm going to turn you on to it. Yes.
I know you're going to try, but I'm not going
to. You know, you used to remind everyone when pumpkin spice was coming, and then it just ended.
No, because I enjoy predicting it, because I have figured out the day that they do it, and it's the Thursday before Labor Day. So that's all. And it doesn't matter if Labor Day is the second, so then you're back in, you know, the third week of August or whatever. It's the Thursday before Labor Day is when pumpkin spice comes out. I figured out their calculation. So
I think the retailers are just trying to make us all happy, because now they're putting out like the Halloween stuff on top of the Christmas stuff. And they're like, look, we're just going to throw it all out there. Pick what makes you happy. Here's the Hanukkah stuff. Here's the Kwanzaa stuff. Grab it all and just decorate your house and be so happy, because, you know, things in the world are a little crazy. They'll get better. But until then, you know, it's just like a pick your poison thing.
Well, I appreciate it. Appreciate you. And can't wait to see what we talk about next week.
Yes, me as well. Everyone stay safe. Take care of each other, and goodbye.
Take care. I'll talk to you later. Bye.